This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our week-long series of shows devoted to the 20-year anniversary of the civil unrest in Cincinnati. Today, our focus is on economic disparities here among racial groups. Over the Rhine looks a lot different than it did 20 years ago, when some say disinvestment in the community helped further the civil unrest that happened there in 2001 after the deaths of multiple black men by Cincinnati police. Following those events were the decisions to renovate blocks at a time. And what does the future hold now that this neighborhood is billed as one of the coolest neighborhoods in North America? WVXU's Corey Sharber and Ann Thompson report on this 20-year anniversary of the day a Cincinnati police officer shot and killed Timothy Thomas in Over the Rhine.
We meet 3CDC President Steve Lieber outside and masked up at what, in the early 2000s, used to be a series of rundown and boarded-up buildings.
12th here in Vine, this was ground zero.
12th and Vine is now flourishing with upscale shops, housing, and retail. The nonprofit real estate company brings a stack of impressive before and after pictures. But Lieber says there are still hundreds of affordable housing units.
And then right next to it, you have condominiums in this building, that building, and then there's another affordable housing on each one of the corners over there. So it's reflective of the neighborhood.
How did they transform the neighborhood? And who did it leave behind? 20 years ago, crime was through the roof and the neighborhood was falling into disrepair. That's when public and private industry stepped in to buy and renovate 200 buildings.
UC Urban History Professor Ann Delano Steinert was watching the change from afar. She lived in Over the Rhine before, during and after the unrest, but then moved to New York. She's back now and thinks 3CDC barreled through the neighborhood.
You know, I'm of two minds about it. Did they save the architecture? Yeah, and that's amazing. Did they cause displacement and financial hardships for longtime residents? I think they did that as well.
Delano Steinert liked the diversity of the neighborhood, remembering when people experiencing homelessness hung out at Washington Park and her neighbors were mostly low-income African-Americans. Like Delano Steinert, Mike Stalin is white. He moved to Over the Rhine in 1989 and still lives there. At some point, he realized his neighbors were moving out.
Some people, their building was bought and they just gave eviction notice to everybody. Some people, the rents just got higher and higher every year and they just couldn't do it anymore.
Stalin says if he didn't own his own building, he probably would have left.
Somebody who was forced to move his martial arts school and mom-and-pop store was black business owner Reginald Stroud. For a decade, he rented 1123 and 1125 Walnut. Then Urban Sites bought the building.
And they gave us 45 days to move. And to boot, they gave us this offer of $200 to help us to relocate.
Urban Sites offered to rent other buildings, but Stroud says those cost three times as much. The development company says his property was in very poor condition and there were safety issues. Stroud eventually got back on his feet and runs his store, called Anybody's Dream, in Northside.
That term gentrification does something to me, because that's exactly what it was. It was someone who was swinging or wielding a much larger sword, felling a much smaller person, you know, who didn't have the capacity to fight back.
Over the Rhine Community Housing is working hard to keep low-income residents in the neighborhood. It manages affordable housing units, which have been decreasing over the past two decades. A study by the Community Building Institute and Xavier University shows Over the Rhine lost more than 40% of its affordable housing units between 2002 and 2015. Executive Director Mary Rivers says the challenge is that affordable rents aren't enough to cover the cost of operating a housing unit.
It has to almost be an emission-driven entity that owns the property because it's not a moneymaker. The market cannot reach $400 a month rents and sustain it, you know, or $500 a month rent when it costs $700 to operate it responsibly.
Rivers says property values are going up, and that means higher taxes. She had hoped the unrest would spark change, but says economic disparities brought up during protests were never addressed.
How can we do things differently so the benefits are more widely shared? And it is so hard for people to approach it from that angle. Whenever we've brought it up, we've been shouted down, dismissed. It's just frustrating. Why can't we talk about it in those terms?
3CDC's Steve Leeper says his agency is working with neighborhood organizations to make Over the Rhine representative. As we walk down 12th Street, he greets old and young, white and black.
It survived the civil unrest. It survived the disinvestment that went on in this neighborhood. It's now surviving. It's going to survive this pandemic.
3CDC is pushing north of Liberty, buying, renovating, and building. One big project involves rehabbing the Over the Rhine Recreation Center, Finley Playground, and Grant Park. I'm Ann Thompson.
And I'm Corey Schreiber, 91.7 WVXU.
And you are listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The city is taking steps to recognize inequalities in its economy. And Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley says it's also taking action to improve the situation. I spoke with the mayor earlier. Here is our pre-recorded interview. Joining us now is Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. Mayor Cranley, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Michael, it's good to be with you.
So it's 20 years since the civil unrest in 2001, and I know you were around the city building in that period. In two decades since, we thought we'd just start by giving you the opportunity to reflect a little bit on your thoughts of what this 20th anniversary means in the context of where the city is now, where it's going.
Look, I think it's the it was prior to COVID and George Floyd over the last year. It was the biggest inflection point for the city in my lifetime. And as you mentioned, I had a front row seat and was also involved in some of the many changes that came out of 2001. If you think about where the city was in 2001, we had deep racial tensions. We had been at the tail end of 50 years of depopulation in the city. And 20 years later, we are growing, the first major city in Ohio to have been losing population and growing again. We're seeing an incredible renaissance in our neighborhoods, in our city. We're the biggest economy, according to the Milken Institute, in the state of Ohio. More people are moving to Cincinnati than even Columbus for the first time. And so we are night and day from where we were 20 years ago. And I would submit and strongly believe that it was getting serious about what ultimately became the collaborative agreement in 2001 that was the precondition to our economic rebound. And there's no question that without the events of 2001 and the advocacy of the civil rights community, including Damon Lynch and others, we would not have made those changes. And I'm glad that we did. I'm glad that I supported the changes and helped to negotiate a lot of the changes. And we've only refreshed and updated the collaborative over the last 20 years, including making major reforms in December of 2020.
And we're talking with Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. And now you're the mayor of the city. And we still see that the city struggles in parity related to income and growth of minority-owned businesses. I know this is something that you announced recently you want to focus on. You were joined by some leaders of minority-oriented organizations like the Urban League, the African American Chamber, the Minority Business Accelerator to make an announcement related to stimulus funds. This is something you're looking for in the future, but we still have all this data that indicates that there is quite a disparity as it relates to Black-owned businesses, their success in the pandemic and prior. So talk a little bit about what your initiatives are.
Well, yes, I believe that the disparities that have been chronicled by the Urban League in the state of Black Cincinnati 6 years ago and through this pandemic, which has hit harder communities of color than other communities, that we have an unacceptable level of disparity in this community. The program that we announced last week is a historic and revolutionary approach where the African American Chamber of Commerce, the Urban League, the Minority Business Accelerator are developing a plan to double the number of African American owned businesses that gross $1 million a year in 5 years and to stabilize 3,000 Black microenterprises and get them to be sustainable businesses to join the middle class. I think it's important in terms of context that When I became mayor in 2013, the city did about 2% a year in contracts with African-American-owned businesses. And now we do routinely at least 11%, so a five-fold increase. So this has been an intentional effort during the whole time I've been mayor. And it's also the case that coming out of 2001, that the establishment of the Minority Business Accelerator, which is best in its class nationally, has already generated the second highest number of businesses that gross more than $1 million a year in the country on a per capita basis. And so there has been some success. However, to the disparity, there's a huge drop off between sort of the very, very successful businesses, which we have more than most cities, except all but Atlanta, Black-owned businesses, to a much greater churn and unacceptable levels of disruption at sort of the small micro-enterprise businesses that are, you know, $150,000 a year or less. And in fact, the African-American Chamber of Commerce has reported that 30% of businesses owned by African-Americans over the last year went out of business during the COVID experience. So the effort we announced last week is meant to really create a permanent continuous improvement infrastructure to sustain and grow Black microenterprises, not just at the high end, although that's a good thing too, but at the smaller end as well. And the fact that Procter & Gamble has agreed to support this initiative is huge. And I hope will be as consequential 20 years from now than as 20 years ago, the collaborative agreement and the establishment of the Minority Business Accelerator was to our city's history.
Mayor, can you tell us what you've learned about why Black-owned enterprises appear to be more vulnerable to closure during the pandemic?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with retail. You know, a lot of sole proprietors are nail salons, beauty salons, you know, barbershops. You've got, you know, restaurants. And these, because people were afraid to go outside for public health reasons, you know, they were harder to get through. But I'm sure the African-American Chamber and others can give better data on that.
When we look at the income inequality in Cincinnati as it relates to Black people and white people, a report from just a few years ago indicated that Cincinnati ranked 60th in economic disparity between white residents and Black residents, with white income averaging about $62,000 and Black residents just under $30,000. How does this initiative help address that?
Well, I mean, a lot of the folks, I mean, if you're running a, you know, a beauty salon, a landscape business, you know, restaurant, and you're grossing $150,000 a year and you have employees, you're not going to take more than 30 grand home. If you're able to grow that business to 300,000-400,000, you're going to generate a 60,000 or more income, which is a middle class income. And you know, this is key to building a more ownership and entrepreneurial opportunities for all parts of our community. And I if we're successful here, I believe we're going to see incomes rise, you know, to close or narrow those disparities.
When we think back to 20 years ago, back in 2001, when we had the unrest here across the city for those 3 days in April, what is the impact, or what could be the impact, of improving the economic lives of Black residents as it relates to their own feelings about their broader community?
Well, I think that, you know, there's no question that the primary anger at the time was about the treatment of Black citizens by the Cincinnati police. And there's written and documented improvement in the public perception by Black Cincinnatians of the Cincinnati Police Department. That's not to say that everyone believes it's great or perfect, but it's substantially higher in terms of public support than, say, police nationally have been in the wake of last year's events in Minneapolis and elsewhere. And so I think that there has been a dramatic, measurable improvement in terms of feeling honored as citizens, more than targeted as citizens. again, not that it's perfect, but it's made demonstrable success.
Also, when we think back to 2001, Over the Rhine comes to mind, and there's probably not a neighborhood in the city that has seen more of a transformation than Over the Rhine in the 20 years since. It's undeniably an economic success, but it's received plenty of criticism for its displacement of lower-income people, particularly people of color. I'm wondering, Mayor, do you think that there is an opportunity to restore any type of sense of ownership of that community to Black Cincinnatians who maybe once called it home or still call it home and perhaps feel displaced?
Well, look, we want a neighborhood in city, all neighborhoods in the city to feel welcome to all. But I think that, you know, some basic facts are important. You know, in 1970, the population of Over the Rhine was roughly 30,000 people. In 2001, it was 5,000 people prior to April. We had literally over 2,000 vacant buildings in 2001. And it was a very, very high crime neighborhood, high poverty neighborhood, low opportunity neighborhood. And it's also the fact that today we have more, not less, affordable public housing in Over the Rhine than we did in 2001. It is certainly the case that a lot of those vacant buildings have filled up, and we have more of an economically vibrant neighborhood and much lower crime. But I would argue that's been good for all residents.
Should there be any sense of a priority to help establish some of these Black-owned enterprises there as the progress in Over the Rhine continues, as more of those buildings are restored and that there are more commercial spaces made available?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, A, it's an ongoing effort, and B, yes, we will do more of it. But there was a big article just last 48 hours about a number of new African-American-owned businesses that 3CDC has cited in Over the Rhine. And I think they're now up to 20-25% of all the retail that they've established is African-American-owned and operated, which, if my guess is the highest it's ever been.
So we've got a reflection going on from what happened in the city 20 years ago, but I know more immediately, perhaps, we're also reflecting on what's happened in the country over the past year, certainly last year, with the deaths of more Black people at the hands of police that caused more civil unrest across the country, including here in Cincinnati. Can you talk a little bit about how the events of last year have driven any reflection from a government perspective, any change in policy?
Well, look, I mean, you know, in December of 2020, you know, I'm proud to have led an effort that was urged on by the civil rights community to change the arbitration system for how we discipline police officers. The longstanding belief, and my belief, was that when the chief issued discipline against officers for misconduct, they were too often overturned. And we've had stories like that where punishments have been meted out in reverse by arbitrators. And so we changed that. And I think we're the first major city in America to get arbitration reform on police discipline. So I'm very proud of that fact. And it certainly, I think, has heightened the business community's awareness around racial justice issues. In fact, the effort we announced last week with the Urban League of the African American Chamber of Commerce has the support of Procter & Gamble, and they've committed to helping to bring other business community members along. And I think the experiences of last summer have given everyone in our community an even greater sense of urgency around these issues.
What about you personally? You're a white guy. I'm a white guy. I know that, we've been asked to reflect, right? I mean, we've been asked to think about any biases that we might have or any misunderstanding of the situation that we might have. Can you talk a little bit about your own processes and your own reflection that you've done as it relates to racial justice since last year?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you know, racism is the original sin of American history. And while there has been a significant progress, there's still many, many miles to go. And, you know, even, you know, one thing that's really struck me is that the protests last year, which was the largest I've ever seen in our city and were very diverse, white and black protesters, were very different from the protests and the anger in 2001. But if you go back and you look at the in-custody deaths of Roger Owensby and of Nathaniel Jones, both of which happened in that time, well, one was in 2000, the other was in 2003, but all in that time period of sort of the collaborative and the changes. In both cases, the suspect was suffocated to death by the Cincinnati police, including the use of chokeholds. And while we all agreed that those were unjustified at the time, the broader awareness beyond the Black community was pretty small. And certainly the kind of national reaction that I think the broader American community had to witnessing what happened to George Floyd, I think demonstrates that in general, there are more allies today than there were 20 years ago. And even though I was on the side of reform 20 years ago, I don't know that I would have drawn the same. I think seeing George Floyd's video and then comparing it to what happened to Roger Owensby and Nathaniel Jones is incredibly similar set of facts. And it's something that I think we should all, it should give us all pause. Because there was the reaction to those in custody deaths 20 years ago both of them were much more mixed at the time as to whether or not it was fair or justified reaction to the circumstances. And in both cases, whereas it was universal condemnation to George Floyd's circumstances. So I view that as positive change. But as I reflect back on 2001, it also sort of hits me in the gut that we really did need change. And the contrast of the way those three cases were handled differently is a reminder of that.
John Cranley is the mayor of Cincinnati. Mayor Cranley, thank you so much for the time you gave us. We always appreciate when you come on.
Thank you.
And up next, we've got a live panel discussion on whether economic development that occurred after 2001 in places like Over the Rhine has helped or hurt the Black communities in those neighborhoods. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The unrest that tore through Over the Rhine in 2001 was, on the surface, about the death of Timothy Thomas and other Black men at the hands of police. But its roots went much deeper, some activists argue, involving economic frustrations among Cincinnati's Black residents that continue to this day. While the city has made some efforts to bridge a yawning wealth and income gap between its white and non-white residents, some question whether economic development that occurred after 2001 in places like Over the Rhine has helped or hurt the Black communities in those neighborhoods. So that's what we're going to talk about now. Joining Cincinnati Edition are New Prospect Baptist Church Pastor Reverend Damon Lynch III. Reverend Lynch, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Over the Rhine Community Housing Executive Director Mary Burke Rivers. Mary, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We also have University of Cincinnati Department of Sociology Associate Professor Dr. Derek Brooms. Dr. Brooms, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we are also working to connect with Mrs. Georgia Keith. She has lived in Over the Rhine for 50 years and will be joining us by phone, and we'll say hello to her momentarily. Reverend Lynch, let's start with you. We've talked a lot this week about the events of 2001, what led up to them and the impact of them, but let's talk specifically about the neighborhood over the Rhine. Obviously, it's become part of a national conversation about what neighborhoods can look like when they're brought back to life. But what has it meant to people on the ground there who were there before this transformation took place? What does the neighborhood look like to you? What does it feel like to you now?
I came to Over the Rhine and I was 29 years old. It was like 1989. I became the pastor of New Prospect Baptist Church, which is located on Elm and Finley. And I fell in love with the people. When I came to Over the Rhine, there was an Over the Rhine plan for almost 16,000 people lived there at the time. A majority African-American, majority below the poverty line. But I fell in love with the people, not the Italianate architecture, the people. And when you look at that same community now, clearly there's been a transformation. All the local bars began to close. The laundromats began to close. The drugstores left. And now it's the sushi bars and the microbreweries. It's a totally different community, and it actually breaks my heart because the people are gone. The Italian architecture is still there, but the people that I fell in love with, the Linda Brocks, the Marva Hurleys, the Julie Fays, those mothers and grandmothers who held that community together are no longer there. So it's kind of heartbreaking for me.
About those folks you mentioned who are no longer there, why is that, do you think?
Many of them have passed on. Others have been moved out, mainly to the west side of town. The Denhart properties were no longer project-based, but people got vouchers and they were able to move. There was a concerted effort. It happened before 2001 that the city wanted to take Over the Rhine. And when I first got there, Buddy Gray was still alive. And the fight was at that time that Over the Rhine did not become a parking lot for downtown Cincinnati. Well, you know, Cincinnati is bordered by the river. You can't go any further south downtown. If you want to grow, you have to come north. So Over the Rhine was taken from the community through private process. 3CDC came into being around that time. And we see what happened.
We'll come back to you momentarily, Reverend Lynch. I want to note that we are joined on the phone by Mrs. Georgia Keith, who has lived in Over the Rhine for 50 years. Georgia, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm so grateful that you would take some time to talk with us today. I know that you've lived there for half a century in Over the Rhine. You lived nearby the tragedy that spawned the civil unrest back in 2001, and you've seen a lot of change take place in that neighborhood. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what the neighborhood looks and feels like now compared to what it was like 50 years ago?
You know, I concur with Reverend Lynch, and it's not the same. Years ago, it was more, to me, it felt like family because there were people. There were neighbors in the community that were older and was more knowledgeable, and we got along as family. We looked after each other, and it's, you know, it might not have looked like what the developers nowadays wanted it to look like, but it was home. It was home to many. And I felt comfortable, you know, being here. And it's sad to say that those neighbors and those community dwellers at the time are no longer here. And like Reverend Lynch said, they've passed on or they have been moved to other neighbors who are, you know, rather on the west side, or some have gone to Claremont County, believe it or not.
Mrs. Keith, you said that you felt comfortable there. Do you no longer feel comfortable in your neighborhood?
Cautious. I feel comfortable. Trust me, I feel comfortable now, but I'm cautious, not because of crimes or anything like that. I'm cautious due to the fact of I'm trying to welcome people, but I'm cautious as to what I say. I'm a boisterous person. I believe in speaking my feelings, but like I say, it's not crime. As I did previously, I was cautious. I wasn't afraid of anything. But, you know, I don't want to hurt nobody's feelings. That's why I'm more cautious now in how I word things. That's what I mean about that.
Well, I don't want to put you in a position to where you feel like you might say something that violates that caution that you practice. But is there something that is... You talked about hurting people's feelings. Whose feelings, may I ask?
Anybody's, whether it's black, white, or indifferent. You know, I don't want to be a person that will say something. I might say something that will benefit me. I want to say something that benefits all, if you know what I'm saying. I don't want to be a person that says, oh, she's not for us. I'm for everybody. You know, but I do believe in speaking my feelings. I don't know if that answers your question. But...
Sure, Mrs. Keith, we're grateful that you're with us today, and I'm going to come back to you momentarily. I want to bring in Dr. Derek Brooms. He's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Brooms, what has transformed over the Rhine is not a unique set of circumstances or experiences for neighborhoods that were previously occupied by majority black populations. And can you talk a little bit about that in the broader context of Cincinnati overall?
Yes, thank you for the question. I'm struck by what Pastor Lynch has said and what Mrs. Keith, just offered. And so one of the things that we know is that there's two things kind of happening I think we really need to pay attention to. And that is overwhelmingly when we look at, in particular, in urban communities across various locales, one of the things that often leads in the narrative is the threat or crime. And so that's one of the things that folks might use in offering a narrative of these kind of, you know, locations where there's a high population of black folks. And so then that kind of sparks particular types of, responses in people with regards to how do they engage with, navigate, or try to make sense of that space. And so what we've seen in a city like Cincinnati, very similar to what we've seen in places like Omaha, I'm from Chicago, in places like Chicago, Detroit, et cetera, overwhelmingly, and this is kind of what Pastor Lynch talked about, is there's a significant divestment in black communities, these communities that may have been differently populated especially up until the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, in the height and in a bit of the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the Black Freedom Movement in the mid-20th century. And so we see an exodus of white folks out of these communities in Cincinnati's, you know, this is a similar history in Cincinnati, and we see an influx of black peoples. And then what we see is that businesses begin to move to where they believe their clientele is, and that's to suburbs, et cetera. There's also kind of state-supported things that happen here where, you know, vouchers are provided or some type of economic tax benefit or relief is provided for both people to move or for businesses to move. And so when people move, when black folks have moved to these neighborhoods, they're not the same neighborhoods that they had been attracted by. And so this kind of creates, you know, this real tension between the communities and the folks who live there and then how folks are seeing these. And this is especially exacerbated when you look at proximity to central business districts. So as we can look at over the Rhine, I could think about Cabrini Green in Chicago, just a mile away from the central business district. And with this, these spaces become very attractive for business development because in many instances, local governments are putting profits over people.
I want to ask Dr. Brooms, because even within the community itself, when we talk specifically about over the Rhine, you can walk several blocks and see how much it's transformed. You can see the vibrance. You can see the new housing. You can see all of the new businesses. It does stop rather suddenly. And then you see the remnants of the pre-Renaissance period. And obviously, there are probably plans out there for a lot of those buildings that haven't been touched yet. But they still exist in the shape they were in. What does that do within the community when you have one side of the street overwhelmingly rehabbed with new faces and the other side of the street with people who predated that?
Yeah. Cincinnati in general, but Over the Rhine very specifically, is a shining example of the stark realities of, if we will, things related to kind of hope and becoming and neglect and divestment. And so if you drive through Over the Rhine, if you walk through Over the Rhine, I mean, it is not only do you see the physical, but there's, I would argue to your question, there's a psychological impact of that, right? So that if I live in, one of these spaces or I frequent one of these spaces and I can look across the street or look just right down the street and see these significant forms of investment, I have to ask questions. Where's the investment in the services that I need in terms of, to meet my daily, everyday needs? Or who are the clientele that we're really trying to cater to? And so that's the kind of psychological, I think, impact that folks have. And when people have to move out, I think that sense of this divestment really impacts them.
That's Dr. Derek Brooms, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati. We're also joined by Over the Rhine Community Housing Executive Director, Mary Burke Rivers. Mary, thank you for being patient with us while we make our way across the panel here to talk about Over the Rhine. Your organization was the result of a 2006 merger between the Race Street Tenant Organized Cooperative, which was founded back in 1977, and the Over the Rhine Housing Network, founded in 1988. So the work that your organization does predates this renaissance, this redevelopment in the community. But do you see equity in the developments and the renaissance that have taken place in your neighborhood?
Thank you. And I want to share, too, that I've been with the organization since 1993. In terms of equity, there's a lot that I'd like to share. One is that between 2002 and 2019, $1.4 billion was invested in Over the Rhine through 3CDC. And that investment had a very direct impact on building wealth for white people, and in some cases directly displaced, in other cases indirectly displaced Black people. So if I bought one of the condos in 2006, 2008, 2010, I could turn around, and maybe I bought it for $300,000. I could turn around and sell that a couple years later for over $600,000. So as a white person who bought that, I walk away with over $300,000 in my pocket. We can't say the same for the Black people who lived in the neighborhood. Instead of building wealth, they were moved out. Another data point that was shared in a report that was published by Drexel University, and the author was Bruce Katz. He's an advocate for what's happened here and a promoter of 3CDC around the country and around the world, really. And some stats that he shared, even as he was celebrating what's happened here, is that from 2000 to 2017, the Black population dropped slightly in the city, but fell by almost a half in Over the Rhine, from 5,010 people to 2,631 residents. The white population decreased in the city of Cincinnati as a whole, but doubled in Over the Rhine. So we saw, white folks moving in and Black folks being moved out. We've lost people, we've lost affordable units. And as others have said, this is not unique to Over the Rhine or to Cincinnati or to this time in history. It's kind of the history of our country, really, that investment benefits white folks and pushes out Black folks. And Mindy Fullilove, she's a clinical psychiatrist at the New School in New York. And what she says is when anything goes wrong in a city, policymakers all too often just want to move Black people around. And she also says that our system is hostile to understanding and that that has really been my experience over the last 20 years, that our economic system and the forces behind it are hostile to understanding maybe the downside of how we operate and of the significant investment in Over the Rhine. As I look out my window, I can look at Washington Park, and it is beautiful. There's no doubt about it. And it's safe. But could we have done something better and something different? Could half of that $1.4 billion gone into the pockets of the Black people who live here? And what would that look like today? That could be really dramatic.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We finish now with our discussion on the economic divide in Cincinnati and root causes of the civil unrest. We're joined on Cincinnati Edition now by New Prospect Baptist Church pastor, Reverend Damon Lynch III, Over the Rhine Community Housing Executive Director, Mary Burke Rivers, and we have a 50-year resident of Over the Rhine, Georgia Keith, and University of Cincinnati Department of Sociology Associate Professor Dr. Derek Brooms. Mary, I want to start with you this time. We've only got a few minutes left. I want to make sure I touch base with all of you one more time before we do this. But what are your hopes moving forward?
My hope is that we can take an honest look about what happened in Over the Rhine over the last 20 years with investment. And it's not to demonize anyone or to shame anyone, but it's to take an honest look so that we can figure out how to do things differently going forward so that the benefits are more widely shared and more impactful for the Black community as this gentrification happens throughout our city and cities across the country, that we can learn from this.
Dr. Brooms, you're an educator. What should the city learn from this as it creates future policy?
I think there's a couple of things here, and I'm a little bit echoing what Mary just mentioned, and that is that, you know, we have to think about ways that benefits can be more equitable. And so economic development is kind of one pursuit, but we know that there's also significant costs to pursuing economic benefits. There's people who don't benefit as much or actually bear some of the brunt of dislocation, dispossession, as you know, my colleagues have mentioned earlier. I think what we got to learn is we got to take a holistic approach because there are ways in which we're still very racially fractured in this city. And we need to understand that while there is a great need for kind of economic revitalization, it's also not necessarily the only thing that's going to change and impact people's lives. And so when we look at the number of joblessness and unemployment in this city, you know, Black unemployment is almost, if not more than double of white unemployment. And so when I think about investment in communities, investment in neighborhoods, it's not just from a business venture standpoint, we have to invest in people. And so that means access to services, health, welfare, well-being. And so I really, you know, my hope and my desire would be for, you know, local officials and community members to really continue to push for a holistic approach so that we improve people's quality of life that then adds to, you know, their health and well-being.
Georgia Keith has lived in Over the Rhine for 50 years. She saw neighbors have to move after their buildings were purchased by new developers. Georgia, what do you hope the future holds for this neighborhood you've lived in for so long?
I hope that we can come together and be mindful that people make a community. People build economics, not a one-sided affair. I want to use that word. Black, white, indifferent, whomever. We all work. I'm retired, but we all spend our money. And we need it to be treated fairly. Don't just bring the whites in here because they may have $1 more than me. But my dollar spends just as well or is more valuable as the other person. I hope that we can come together and see that people make the neighborhood. People build a community. And we all bleed the same color blood, so why can't we come together to be more mindful of this development or these living situations? this developing situation. So we all need housing. We all need homes. But you don't have to put $6 signs over a $1 sign when it's all the same as far as spending. I think we all can come together to build this neighborhood the way. I'm not saying that it's not beautified, but the thing, look what you had to do to beautify this neighborhood. You had to vacate a race in order to get what you want. And that's not the way it should be.
Reverend Damon.
We all are one. Right.
Reverend Damon Lynch is the pastor at New Prospect Baptist Church, and we just heard the words there of longtime resident of Over the Rhine, Georgia Keith, Reverend, and I'm wondering if there is a way to move forward based on what she said and what people like her have experienced there.
I appreciate the wisdom of everyone on the panel today. We have not learned anything in this in these last 20 years.
Right.
Go down to the West End. There's a huge stadium sitting right in the middle of a predominantly African-American community that the community said they did not want. The same thing that happened in Over the Rhine is now happening in the West End. It is also happening in Avondale when you have major institutions that are buying up entire streets and displacing people and tearing down homes. It's in Evanston and Walnut Hills, Bond Hill, Roseline through the Port Authority. So no, clearly we have not learned a lesson. Even going back to Kenyon Bar, which was the old West End that was destroyed, and 26,000 predominantly African-American people had to leave their homes. So what we need to do is practice community economic development as a Black community. We need our own community safety plan. It was the police shooting of Timothy Thomas 20 years ago today that initiated the civil unrest. And so the first responders should not just be police officers. The community used to be the first responders, and we need our own community education plan. So it is incumbent upon the Black community now to organize and to continue to fight and protect the quote unquote Black communities, because in the next 20 years, none of them will exist.
Reverend Damon Lynch, Mary Burke Rivers of Over the Rhine Community Housing, University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Sociology, Dr. Derek Brooms, and 50-year Over the Rhine resident, Georgia Key. Thank you all for this very enjoyable and informing conversation. I think we might have cause to assemble this panel again sometime. Thank you for all the time you gave us today.
Thank you
for having
me. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.